means for this rediscovery not philosophy, but the great imaginative literature and poetry of the West, and activities such as song, dance, and stargazing. In their teaching, the professors brought out vital human questions present in the readings. What is a home? What is a friendship? What is justice? What is healthy work? What is the happy life? Dealing with them in concrete ways. They told pertinent stories and quoted literature and poetry, striving to invite their students to taste the mysterious beauty at the heart of these values, more than to be able to define them. Above all, they had to instill in this youth the awareness that things are delightful and wonderful, beautiful, good, and true.
Welcome back, Rowdy. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah, how was your week, man?
It was good, man. Nothing too crazy. Had its downs and its ups, but no major valleys, no major mountains, just living life.
We had a very intense week in my house. So me and my dad took the first step on Butcher Day and slaughtered two cows. It's always a great experience. It's always kind of humbling. And my dad always kind of shows me up on those days. So that was nice. It's good memories, too, just to spend that time with my dad. I think those are memories I'll keep for the rest of my life, of me and my dad doing something very difficult together. So I love that. But it was really a busy week. I also planted some seeds. You know, my garage, or as I call it, the greenhouse this time of year. It's been a fun week. A lot of homesteading stuff, I guess, happening this week.
I know. I'm a little jealous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. you'll get into that too, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I'm so ready. Marissa and I both talk about homesteading, and both of us want to do it, do all the things, right? All the animals, all the gardening, so.
Especially the milk cow.
Definitely wasn't that adventurous, but what was it like to, I remember growing up and hunting animals and butchering those animals, and sometimes it's kind of, especially as a kid, wrestling with taking a life, not necessarily a human life, obviously, but there's still a life that is being taken. So what is that like with your mentality these days?
Yeah, I tell people it's always hard, but that's the cost of eating meat. Is really, if you're going to be eating meat, you should have butchered one or at least understand what it cost. So yeah, it's always difficult, and there's a mix of sadness and joy at the same time. The joy, because you know that you'll be able to feed your family for a whole year with this meat. So that's a joyful thing to do. The sheer quantity that you have. I mean, I have two whole cows hanging in the walk-in cooler right now. So, but yeah, then you got to do something with that, you know, and that's where the fun begins.
Yeah.
But so yeah, I mean, it's always sad, and it should be sad. If it's not a little bit sad, then you're not really human.
Yeah.
Because you haven't realized the cost, but it's also a wonderful thing. Well, and I didn't grow up doing any of this, and I think boys need this, men need this. Mm-hmm. I started later in life. The first time I went hunting, I was in my 20s, and I was already married because my family wasn't hunters. My dad didn't ever go hunting. He never took me. But I always had that desire. So, Rap, last 2 weeks, we've been immersing ourselves in these Aesop's fables.
Yes, sir. Just a quick summary of what I thought was, it was interesting, man, because a couple of these are recognizable, right? They're worded differently, especially in this translation, but I think I was struck by the simplicity of it, because I was coming in thinking it was going to be like a couple page stories. No, it's maybe a paragraph. Some of them are like a sentence. And then Lestrange, the author of our translation, writes like two pages of a reflection on a sentence. Crazy how much you can get out of these stories and how short they are. I think that's what initially struck me.
Hopefully you were able to mine this for the gold that it is. I thought it was really an important book to be read. I definitely understand why it's a classic and why we should be reading Aesop's Fables to our children. I think it teaches a lot of truth about life. I think some of the fables are kind of crazy and maybe don't make as much sense. Maybe we've lost the stomach for it. Yeah, there's a lot of gold there still. Rowdy, who was Aesop?
Who was Aesop? So it seems like everyone that I asked about this was like, oh yeah, Aesop's Fables. But to be completely honest with you, I had never heard of Aesop.
Yeah, me neither.
until we started talking about this. I've talked to a few people about it because they see me reading it. I'm like, yeah, Aesop's Fables. That's like Mother Goose's nursery rhymes. I have never in my entire life heard of Aesop's Fables. So I'm just going to read Lestrange's overview of who he was to be brief with it. Aesop is believed to have been a Greek slave on the island of Samos. And according to Herodotus and other classical writers, he was killed by the people of Delphi, who threw him off a rock after he had committed some grave offense against them. Legend has it that he was misshapen, ugly, and spoke with a stammer, but his storytelling was famed for its wit, and his ability to teach lessons in morality through story has made his name synonymous with the genre of fable. None of the stories attributed to him existed in written versions until about 300 BC.
There it is.
Added through the centuries to the collections appearing under his name, so it is impossible to know how many of the tales in this book were told originally by the man himself, whoever he was.
There's also a longer account in the beginning of the book that I immediately kind of balked at because it seems like it's just a critical theory. Did Aesop ever exist? Who was this man? Did he write most of these fables or not? To which I respond, who cares? The question is there truth here or not?
Yeah.
Because to me, Aesop existed and he wrote all the fables.
Yeah.
And that's all I need to know, you know?
Yeah.
Or is there truth or not?
For our purposes here, there's a place and a time where it may be beneficial to really dig into the historical roots of the man Aesop, but just to try to really get into the fables, it doesn't necessarily matter who wrote them. Someone did. Someone taught these lessons.
Let's call him Aesop.
Yeah. Why not?
So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some of his fables, some of our favorite ones. We're going to go back and forth a little bit. And we would be remiss if we didn't talk about some of his most commonly known ones. As you might know it, the tortoise and the hare, and the boy of false alarms. Or as most would know it, the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah, like I said in the beginning, I had no idea that those stories came from Aesop's fables. And it's kind of interesting how, even though the story is different from how I've heard it, it's still pretty consistent. It seems like even through these different translations, the message is still the same. But Caleb actually got a pretty different idea from The Boy Who Cried Wolf. Is that the one you're going to now?
Yeah. A shepherd's boy had gotten a rogue trick of crying, a wolf, when there was no such matter. In fooling the country people with false alarms, he had been at this sport so many times in jest that they would not believe him at last when he was in earnest. And so the wolves broke in upon his flock and worried the sheep at pleasure. This is the story of a boy who cried wolf, or the boy in false alarms. So what'd you think about that story, Rowdy?
Well, I mean, initially, I know that one by heart. Or not that exact translation, but the whole story of the boy who cried wolf. The main moral that people draw from that, don't cry wolf. And it's hard to even find other words for it because that's so ingrained in our culture that everyone knows what that means. Don't go cry wolf. Don't go and play around because then people won't believe you. Yeah. But it was hard for me to get away from that. So I didn't really take anything new from it.
See, you know? I took the opposite approach. I read this and thought, I've heard this story probably hundreds of times, and I've never once asked the question of what does it mean or what is the moral of the story. I'm like, well, I'm not a shepherd boy. I don't have any sheep. So what does this story mean? I've never once thought past that. The wonderful thing about Aesop's Fables, when you read it in the way that it's supposed to be read, is you're supposed to ask the question of why is this here? Why does this exist? And so for me, what I got from the story is that we shouldn't be excitable. You know, there's a lot of people who are always talking about themselves, who every day is a crisis, who every day have another problem, who make the entire world about themselves. And what does this do to those around them, those who are forced with tiring ears to listen once again? Well, it makes us not care what that person says. It makes their words really have no weight to it. That's kind of the virtue of silence that used to be talked about a lot. And maybe it was partially because of that. You just tire people's ears, and better to keep your mouth closed and be thought a fool than to open it and remove all doubt. And so I took away from this that we shouldn't be excitable. We shouldn't be always going around telling people the problems in our lives because they're usually pretty small. Try to cultivate silence, and maybe then our words will actually carry more weight.
That's interesting because it's the same moral. But in your version, for instance, the boy's not telling lies. He's just telling everything. Every single thing that goes on in my life, I'm going to tell the world about it, good, bad, and the ugly, yeah, right?
All the everything. Social media.
All the social media. That's interesting. Now that you explain it like that, I'm more on board with it. At first, I was like, I didn't get that at all. That's an interesting takeaway from such a world-renowned fable, I guess if you want to call it that.
Oh, yeah. Know? One that we all know.
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is cultivate silence. Don't be excitable. We don't need that much drama in our life. There's already enough. All right, we got the next one.
All right. So a hare and a tortoise. What a dull, heavy creature, says a hare, if it is the same tortoise. And yet, says the tortoise, I'll run with you for a wager. 'Twas done and done, and the fox, by consent, was to be the judge. They started together, and the tortoise kept jogging on still till he came to the end of the course. The hare laid himself down about midway and took a nap, for, says he, I can fetch up the tortoise when I please. But he overslept himself, it seems, for when he came to wake, though he scudded away as fast as 'twas possible, the tortoise got to the post before him and won the wager.
What a classic. Did you ever think about what this might mean in your early life? I feel like this one was more straightforward, you know, as kids, but did you ever think of the ramifications?
I read it to Marissa last night, and the first words out of her mouth were, slow and steady wins the race. Kind of thought about that, but I don't think that's what the story was intending you to get from it. Because slow and steady does win the race sometimes, but...
most of the time, not. No, yeah. Like the fastest wins the race.
Yeah, because the fable here is, it seems like it's definitely more pointed at the hare. He's doing wrong here. It's not about what the tortoise is doing this. It's the hare being cocky and bragging that he's faster than the tortoise and he can do whatever he wants. The tortoise will never win.
Yeah, there's definitely two sides of this.
Yeah.
And we always think about the tortoise for some reason, and the hare really is the star, the one who lays down and takes a nap midway through, which is just funny. What did you think?
Just like the other one, I don't have a whole lot to take away from it besides the fact that my wife and I both grew up with slow and steady wins the race. But actually reading the story, that's not really what we should focus on. We should focus on don't be overconfident in yourself, right? Any day can be the other person's day. Don't be prideful.
I took in the story of the hare, a critique of myself. With my ADHD, it tends to put off till tomorrow what should be done today. And I think that's what I see in the hair. He's like, I'll take a nap today. I'll put it off till tomorrow.
Yeah.
I can still beat him at the last minute. There's that pride in there that gets him to make him think, of course, I'm faster than a tortoise. He can be far in advance of me, and yet I can wake up and win.
Man, and that's so, procrastination. I didn't even attribute that to this until you said it. I'm such a procrastinator. You can ask anyone in my family, my wife, me always too. Have yeah. been.
I need a deadline.
Went back in school, if I had a project due the night before, I go to my mom or my grandmother, be like, hey, so I got to make a doll by tomorrow. And then I would show up, because my grandmother was an amazing woman, with a perfectly sewed together doll for this certain project. And they'd be like, oh my gosh, it's so good. And
I did that in eighth grade as well for class over Where the Red Fern Grows, and my dad made the whole project, and it was beautiful. The teacher left it in her room for years, and it was great.
The teachers have to know.
I'm sure she knew. I wasn't a very good student.
Like, going along with that, if my grandmother hadn't been there, or your dad hadn't been there, we would have wound up just like the hare. We didn't finish. We got a bad grade. So I didn't even attribute that to procrastination, but it's so true.
I'm sure there's many kids who probably didn't have the luxury that we had of good parents who might not have been able to accomplish the same feats that we did at the last minute because of that. But we had an unfair advantage.
Indeed. And good parents are the root of almost everything that we're probably going to talk about in this podcast. The virtues, it starts in the home. And it starts with mom and dad and having that good family life. It's sad in today's world that we don't have that everywhere. But hopefully we can be a part of the revitalization of that culture.
Well, and I took something from the tortoise too. Slow and steady kind of wins the race, as you say, but we can apply that in a lot of areas of our lives that we don't really think about. This is true for a lot of things. It's better to do consistent things every day than out of excitement to do things all at once. For instance, it's better to work out every single day than to get it in your mind that maybe I should work out. And then that one day you go and you hit the gym real hard, and the next week you're sore. And so you've missed it. Whereas if you would make that small change every day, and I'm saying this as a person who's not good at working out, who procrastinates, and I know all those things, but, and that's true, and that's true in a lot of ways as well, in our spiritual life too, especially in our spiritual life, a lot of times we like to think that prayer needs to look a certain way. There should be specific gifts that we have. Maybe it should be this most amazing thing. Maybe our Lord talks to us in person. But the truth is, it's better to just pray every day.
Yeah.
And that consistency is far better for your spiritual life, for your moral life, for your virtuous life, than anything that you could possibly do by just being excited about it.
Yeah.
You actually grow in the virtue by doing it when you're not excited about it.
That's the part where the virtue comes, is when you're not excited. I wrote down a couple main themes that I found, and on one of those was quality over quantity. Don't try to do the most just to beat someone. Focus on quality.
Whatever virtue you want to grow in, it's what's a little step that I can do today and every day that I would actually do, and then take that step,
yeah.
Make that be the thing. Yeah. Whatever your goal is in life, maybe it's to read 1,000 good books with us. Okay. Just read a few pages every day.
Yeah.
And you'll get there. So, Rowdy, what was one of your fables that you really got a lot out of?
You're gonna put me on the spot here. I have way too many written down that I really not necessarily identified with, but I just found entertaining, even humorous, and some that I did like the moral of the story. But you're gonna make me narrow it down.
For sure.
Let's see. And I didn't send these to Caleb beforehand like I should have. Because you know what I did? I procrastinated. So I'm going to catch him off guard with some of these. We'll start with the funny one, lighten the mood a little bit. But I really enjoyed one that's called A Mountain in Labor. It's on page 81. For those out there listening, there is a website. It's called either 8000goodbooks.com or 1000goodbooks.com. And it has most, if not all, of John Sr.'s list. And some generous person out there has scanned all of these books digitally on that website. And so they're all available. If you don't have the means to purchase books, Caleb and I definitely recommend buying these books and buying these beautiful books and keeping them on a bookshelf for your kids. But if you don't have the means and you still want to follow along, go to that website and you can pull up these fables. They may not be on the exact pages as our translations, but they should be there. And while I was talking, I was not flipping. Okay, yeah, this one is short and sweet. It is called A Mountain in Labor. When mountains cry out, people may well be excused the apprehension of some prodigious birth. This was the case here in the fable. The neighborhood were all at wit's end to consider what would be the issue of that labor, and instead of a dreadful monster that they expected, out comes at last a ridiculous mouse.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
That's what you got. That's short and pithy. I like that. Where you make a mountain out of a molehill, or the moral says here, much ado about nothing.
At first, I wasn't quite sure. When I first read it, I really just thought that it was just nonsense, and that was the point,
mm-hmm.
right? But upon reading it a couple times, it's really just talking about, like you said, we make a mountain out of a molehill. We build things up like they're going to be this some spectacular thing, and then we're underwhelmed, you know? And so it's kind of be weary of that, mm-hmm. You know,
and it's beautiful when we're underwhelmed, I think, in you know, I've done this in my own life, the mountain out of a molehill thing with, I didn't go to the doctor for 10 years until I turned 28. And then I had a good friend who told me, you know, you really need to start going to the doctor and just have the labs done and all that. But I'm kind of a hypochondriac, so I always assume that I'm just going to die. And then I kind of worry about my family. So that was my kind of mountain.
Yeah.
And it was so scary to make the first appointment and to get my labs drawn. And I had a good friend who I worked with who, like, I showed my labs and I was just completely convinced that I had cancer, you know, and worried about it. But I think we do that a lot as human beings. It's probably a universal thing. We all have some sort of a mountain that we're scared of, that we're terrified of. And then luckily, many times it comes back to be a mouse.
That happens for me at work all the time. Everyone has those days where you do not want to roll out of bed. Get your work clothes on and go to work. It's not the cards today, right? You're not motivated whatsoever. You have things that need to be done, but you don't want to do them because you tell yourself that it's the worst thing in the world. You just don't want to get them done. And it's so simple. And then once you do it, you look back and like, that would have taken me 10 minutes if I'd have just done it.
But you thought about it for hours.
Yeah. No, for real. I mean, it happens some days when you just think about this one thing, and it maybe it's a little difficult, a little challenging or mentally taxing, but it's not worth hours of dread.
Yeah, that's the mountain out of the molehill. There was another one, another fable that was sort of like that. It's the camel. The people have never seen this camel before. They encounter the camel, and they're so scared because they think it's going to kill them. And then they come witness it a second time, and they realize it's not really doing anything. It's a little dumb. And then the third time, they come back, and they make it their slave, and they put pecks on it. And that's kind of our lives. You know, there's a lot of things that are scary to us that we've never experienced before. And once we finally walk up to it, once we finally take that first step, we realize it's not really as scary as we thought it would be.
Yeah. There's a couple in that little, because I think that was one of the sets that had like two or three that were connected, that had the same moral. I think one was a lion. You know, someone had never seen a lion before, or maybe like the fox. And at the first sight of it, he thought he was just going to be mauled to death and was absorbed in the lion's beauty. And then, like the camel, the following times, it becomes less mesmerizing. And you can kind of apply that in several ways.
That one's a good one. These are all good. Some of them we might not have understood as well as we should have. And maybe Aesop would look back and go, "You idiots, you missed the whole point on most of these." We'll see one day. Maybe we'll get to meet him. Yeah. That would be pretty cool.
That'd be wild.
He'd be like, "I'm Aesop. I did write all of these fables." One of my favorite ones that I had, and I read this and I loved it immediately, was A City Mouse and a Country Mouse, which is on page 60.
It's also the cover picture of our book.
Hey, I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you can tell a good book by its cover.
But
maybe, yeah. There goes an old story of a country mouse that invited her city sister to the country collation, where she spared for nothing that the place afforded, as moldy crust, cheese parings, musty oatmeal, rusty bacon, and the like. Now the city dame was so well bred as seemingly to take all in good part. But yet at last, "Sister," says she, after the civilest fashion, "why will you be miserable when you may be happy? Why will you lie pining and pinching yourself in such a lonesome, starving course of life as this is, when 'tis but going to the town along with me to enjoy all the pleasures and plenty that your heart can wish?" This was a temptation the country mouse was not able to resist. So that away they trudged together, and about midnight got to their journey's end. The city mouse shooed her friend the larder, the pantry, the kitchen, and the other offices, where she laid her stores, and after this, carried her into the parlor, where they found yet upon the table the relics of a mighty entertainment of that very night. The city mouse carved her companion of what she liked best, and so to it they fell upon a velvet couch together. The poor bumpkin, that had never seen nor heard of such doings before, blessed herself at the change of her condition, when, as ill luck would have it, all of a sudden the doors flew open, and in comes a crew of roaring bullies, with their winches, their dogs, and their bottles, and put the poor mice to their wits' end how to save their skins. The strangers, especially, that had never been at this sport before, but she made a shift, however, for the present, to slink into a corner, where she lay trembling and panting till the company went their way. So soon as ever the house was quiet again, "Well, my court sister," says she, "if this be the way of your town gambols, I'll leave him back to my cottage and my moldy cheese again, for I had much rather lie nabbing on crust without either fear or danger in my own hole than be mistress of the whole world with perpetual cares and alarms." One of my favorite ones. What did you think about
that? Oh, it's good. It's good. Country life better than city life.
Absolutely. Country life better than city life. If you have a chance, move to the country.
Yeah. But the deeper, you know, meaning of that is like everything kind of comes at a price. And so all this luxury, everything we want in life, all these pleasures, they come at a cost. I feel like the moral of the story is, what are you willing to spend? Are you willing to go into the city for all these pleasures if you're going to be under pressure and like danger every day? For the country mouse, wasn't worth it. And I feel like a lot of people these days, it's beginning to be not worth it. Quiet, simple life isn't a bad life.
No. it's desirable, actually. I mean, that's why all the homesteading channels and all that exist. I think this is a rebuke of country people nowadays. There was a wonderful writer, Father Vincent McNabb, who lived, I think, in the early 20th century, was writing about The Church and the Land. That's one of the books he wrote. But he spoke in a park every week and would kind of talk about issues concerning the populace of England. He talks about why we should live in the country. He talks about it and he says that we shouldn't live in the country and live as though we were living in the city. And I think that's what we do nowadays. The country mice here has found that the country brings joy and peace and harmony. And yes, you might have to go hungry a little bit, but at least it doesn't bring the anxiety and the stress of living in the city. And I think we've experienced that. But nowadays, the problem is people who live in the country live as though they're living in the city. They work in the city. Everything they do is in the city. The people that they talk to are in the city. The place they get their food from is in the city. And so they've retained all of the stress and all of the anxiety of city life, and yet they're not even attached to the country because they don't have their hands in the soil. They don't have their eyes in the sky looking up to the stars. And so you should live in the country. You should have less anxiety. But in order to do that, you might actually have to give the whole country living a try.
Yeah.
Not just moving here and living here and not using your land, but you should use your land. And in that, maybe you'll, you know, reach down to pull out some potatoes from the ground and remember that you're dust, and to the dust you'll return.
Yeah.
You'll experience this union with our Lord through creation.
That was wonderful. It's a wonderful way to explain what are the benefits of the toil of country life. And it's hard to see past the sweat and the tears and the hungry stomach to see the beauty in it, to see the beauty in the struggle.
Yeah, I think the beauty is detachment from society, but the problem is we don't detach nowadays.
Yeah. Well, society's in our pockets. It's on our television screens. It's right there 24/7.
24 hours a day.
It is so hard to detach completely. And that was one of the beautiful things about the monastery. I'll probably bring that up so many times because it was just a profound experience for me. The silence and leave your phone behind. You don't need any ringing. You probably will never hear a phone go off in that church. You know, which is,
They would probably be so disappointed. I mean, you can't even get service in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we really have to think about this. It's a tragedy in our grandparents' generation that they felt the need to move to the city. They felt this call of the mouse that it's going to be easier. Maybe they were squeezed out. Maybe they were originally farmers and able to subsist.
Well, it could have been out of necessity, right?
Yeah, I think it was most of the time out of necessity that they felt like they needed to grow, maybe get bigger jobs, maybe farm more land.
Well, it's hard to turn that down, especially as a man who's a father and a husband. The opportunity to like provide something a little more for your family, it's a hard temptation to turn down. And I don't know if I would have made the right choice if I was put in their shoes.
No, I wouldn't.
You know? Either. And so it's
easy to look back, but it seems like a tragedy. What do we usually talk about when we talk about country? We call them country mice, field mice. But what do you say when you think about the city?
Rats. Even though they're different, but...
Yeah, they're different, but you have the city rats, the overindulged, the gluttonous, the disgusting. But even our understanding of this word, I think Aesop did a beautiful job of using the imagery there. And maybe he didn't have that imagery in his day in the 6th century.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something that I had to, through the course of reading this book and the fables, I had to kind of reorder in my mind, is that each animal that Aesop uses is a type. So just for instance, the snake is always a snake. It's always evil. It's always going to get you. And so I was reading some of these stories, and I really was struggling with like Christian charity, because a lot of the stories are like, don't trust people. Yeah. That's what I was getting from it. But you're not supposed to read these stories and give the snake the benefit of the doubt. The purpose of the story is that the snake is a snake and the fox is a mischievous fox. that these people are that way. There's no chance of redemption in this particular story. It's not necessarily how you should live your life. We are called to have the Christian charity and to give people chances and to trust, but the purpose of these fables is to be weary a little bit. So I was really struggling with that. I was like, man, Aesop's very pessimistic. But once you reorder your mind of each of these animals, whoever it is in the story, you know, the lion, the ox, the donkey, the chicken or the fox or whoever, they're playing a part. They're playing a role. They're not just people who could be good or bad. They're either good or bad.
The fables, I think, are probably starting to go out of fashion. One, because parents don't read to their kids anymore. They just set them in front of, you know, Coco Melon or whatever other crack that the kids want to watch. I think these kind of fall flat because we no longer know the experience of a chicken, you know, intimately, or we might have never seen a fox.
Yeah.
Or we may have never seen a snake before. And until you have this intimate knowledge of what these things are, because you've experienced them in nature and you've lived life around them, you know what a sheep looks like when it lays down in pasture and the comfort that it feels. Only then will these kind of open up, because then you get to understand why, you know, it's the mischievous fox.
Yeah.
Then it begins to make sense because you know the nature of the thing.
Well, one great example of that is, I mean, most people probably have seen them in zoos, but lions. Lions in these stories are always the king. They're proud, they're beautiful, they're majestic. They're always that character. And if you've never seen a lion, that kind of falls flat a little bit, right? Like, why is the lion the king? But until you see that ginormous cat.
Or hear the roar,
and they're like 2 feet away from you, and just like a piece of plexiglass is separating you from being mauled to death, you don't really understand the reaction of some of these other animals to the lion. Like, one of those fables was the fox reacting to the lion, and how majestic and just crazy it looked. And if you've never seen the muscles on like a tiger or a lion as they're walking, you just don't get that. And so I totally understand when you're so detached from the farm life and holding a chicken or seeing a snake, you can still get out of these stories what you need to, but it doesn't hit the same.
If Aesop's fables are not making sense to you and it's about a snake, well, hopefully don't find a snake, but maybe you find a snake.
So start with the less dangerous animal.
Yeah, if it's about a sheep, it's one of the favorite parables of the Gospels. It talks a lot about sheep and pastures. Well, if you don't have intimate knowledge of sheep or pastures, it's going to fall flat. So what should you do? You should go out into the pasture with some sheep.
And it sounds trivial. Like, why would that help whatsoever? You know, but it does. It
changes everything.
Because one of the big philosophies of this podcast is the real is real. Being intimate with God's creation is going to just make everything else open up. The next one, I like it a lot, is it's called A Flea and Hercules, which is another cool thing in here. God is represented by the gods. Hercules, Venus, Jupiter, you know, which I find that cool because I always grew up liking Greek mythology. Yeah, it was always interesting. But A Flea and Hercules. There was a fellow that upon a flea biting called out to Hercules for help. The flea gets away and the man expostulates upon the matter. "Well, Hercules," says he, "you that would not take my part against a sorry flea will never stand by me in a time of need against a more powerful enemy." And that's it.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Short and witty.
Short and witty. So I really enjoyed that one because we see that in our daily life. Our lowly toils, maybe, I can't even think of one off the top of my head. Like,
why did the Lord not allow me to win the lottery? You know, like,
well, I think it's something, come on. We want God to do everything for us sometimes. Like, we want him to, just as an example, my wife's mad at me. God, take that away. Fix that for me, you know, and then when he doesn't, because that's not something that he should have to do, because we should do that. Then we're like, if they won't do something small, he's not going to do anything big for me, which doesn't correspond, right?
No. And sometimes it's even big. Maybe they prayed to God once that, you know, their parents wouldn't get a divorce, and then their parents still got a divorce. And so they've experienced that pain. They put that on God. That happens a lot of, well, I no longer believe in him because this fundamental union that I grew up with thinking that it would never break, broke.
Yeah.
So, Lord, how could you allow this to happen to me? Why would you let my parents get divorced? Why would you let evil things happen in my life if you actually exist? People ask that question a lot.
And then we just go on not trusting that he'll ever do anything for us. And maybe it was providence that he wasn't supposed to intervene directly in that. Maybe there's something that's going to come along down the line that's going to make that stuff worth it, because God brings forth good from evil.
And we have to account for our human will, our fallen nature that enables all of these broken things to happen in the world, because he gave us his free will.
Yeah.
So yeah, we can get divorced, and that's a terrible thing, but people experience that.
Yeah, we're not robots, right, that are just meant to love God without any thought. We should love God because we want to love God. And that's infinitely more incredible of God, that he allows us to have free will to love him and not make us love him.
But you know, we do have that free will to another extent. How could anybody look at the stars and not believe that God exists? I'm totally against telescopes. I don't think we should ever use telescopes. I think you should go out and you should look into the sky in a place that doesn't have a lot of light pollution. And then you should see the sky and the stars at night the way that everybody always has with their bare eyes. Because I think the philosophy of the telescope is, I can zoom in on this. And what's the ultimate end of zooming in? Well, it's the atom. I want to know what this is made of. And then you miss the whole point that someone created this. You can start in a correct place, having awe of the stars and the love which moves the stars and the one who created them. And in humility, you can try to learn more. Or you can do what a lot of the scientific people are doing nowadays, which is, I'm going to study what the particles are and miss the whole point of life, of everything. And so I'm against telescopes because they zoom in too much.
I'm going to buy you a telescope for Christmas.
Yeah, I'd probably love it. You know? I'd probably love it.
Yeah, there's a time and a place, but I think scientists have, and it's not necessarily bad, right, that we've zoomed in and we know the atom and it has a nucleus and protons and neutrons and all of that, but we've lost the ability to just see something as it is, how God intended it. There's fruit to be had from zooming in on the moon and being able to see the craters and be able to see this is just a rock floating in space. But then you lose that. That's a rock floating in space. That's a giant rock circling us.
And it only is worth asking the question if we understand that this is intelligible because it was made by an intelligent creator.
Yeah.
And if we've missed that, we're less than the ants. We're just creatures walking on the earth. We haven't understood the most basic thing that kids know, that people naturally know when they are around mountains or on the seashore or looking up into the stars at night, which is that he exists. It's natural. Everybody's always known it.
Yeah.
To not know that.
Yeah. Well, now people look at the Grand Canyon and it's like, well, yeah, just that's just water flow. That's all that is. It's nothing impressive. Just hundreds of feet of rock eroded away. Just water. It's fine. But then again, the Grand Canyon is such a masterpiece of nature. People can see pictures of it and learn about it. But when you go out there and see the Grand Canyon,
you've got to experience it.
Take your breath away. And that comes from somebody who's never seen the Grand Canyon, but I know it's going to when I do see it.
Yeah, when me and my wife on our honeymoon, we went to Estes Park. That was the first time I'd been to the mountains. My family's more of a beach family.
Yeah.
And it just takes your breath away.
You try to take pictures on your phone, and then you look back at them later, and you're like, this is horrible. Yeah. This doesn't even look like what I saw. This isn't what I saw with my eyes. So that's a good example for someone who's a little hesitant at what we're saying. Is if you've ever taken a picture of some nature scene or a beautiful sky at night, and then you look back on it and you're like, yeah, it just doesn't do it justice. Well, that's why. You know, we were meant to see these things with our eyes, and they were meant to be, you know, we're meant to be awestruck by these things, and the beauty of them in a reproduction of them from pixels on your phone is never going to do that justice.
No, it's the same with music.
Yeah, I mean, you go to, you know, a live concert, like you can hear that music on your phone anytime you want these days. But there's just something about being there, it being live. There's people around you who are experiencing it with you.
And you could even experience the best version of it, but it's better to go see it live.
Yeah, definitely. What you got next?
So I got a really scandalous one. It's one of my favorites. It's called The Cat and Venus. And it's on page 135. A young fellow that was passionately in love with a cat made it his humble suit to Venus to turn puss into a woman. The transformation was wrought in the twinkling of an eye, and out she comes, a very buxom lass. The doting sot took her home to his bed, and bade fair for a litter of kittens by her that night. But as the loving couple lay snuggling together, a toy took Venus in the head to try if the cat had changed her manners with her shape. And so for experiment, turned a mouse loose into the chamber. The cat, upon this temptation, started out of the bed and without any regard to the marriage joys, made a leap at the mouse, which Venus took for so high an affront that she turned the madam into a puss again.
Before we dive into that one, I actually did look up the word buxom.
Oh, really?
A very buxom lass. I have a feeling I know what that means, but Merriam-Webster, nothing.
Oh, really?
Nothing.
That's funny.
Doesn't know what it means.
Oh, very nice. Yeah.
I mean, you can kind of gather what he's kind of describing there.
Yeah, but you get it in the context a little bit.
I just thought that was funny that I looked it up and literally there's no definition. Yeah. There's a lot of words in this translation that's like that. But
you know, the present day version of this would be you can't turn a you know what into a housewife, I think. So
we're going to try to keep this G, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, we're going to try to keep it a little bit, you know. We're not going to talk about too many buxom lasses, but we'll see. So
what was your first thoughts and why did it resonate with you?
So my first thoughts were we should choose well in our marriage, you know, like or when you're going to date somebody, you need to choose well.
Don't just let looks guide you.
No, because in our day and age, it's really hard to find a good woman or a good man if you're a woman searching. And so me and Rowdy have been very blessed by our wives. We chose very well. And it's an important thing to choose well your woman. And so I was just thinking a lot of, you know, there's those podcasts or those YouTube videos that I used to see the clips of, like the whatever podcast. And I thought, how sad nowadays that unfortunately so many of these young girls and guys, because there's tons of terrible guys as well, are out there who don't have basic decency, morals, or sense. And yet some of them want to get married, as they should. Hopefully they do, but they need to turn it around first.
Yeah.
So that they can choose well. Because you can't turn a person who, you know, sells her body on OnlyFans into a good housewife without a strong conversion. I mean, of course, there is always our Lord who converts us and has converted both you and me into his holy bark. And so we should, you know, also hope and pray for them.
Yeah.
But there is some things that, you know, some people are just certain ways.
And with that being said, the physical beauty of a woman or of a man isn't just inherently evil, right? We're soul and body. God created our bodies just how they are.
Yeah, it's inherently good.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be the primary means of attraction or of a reason or want to marry or a want for a relationship, because just like we've been talking about for a lot of this podcast, from dust we came to dust we shall return. Yeah. And sometimes the body, it don't look too good when you're about to go back to the dust, you know? And so those things fade away. But what doesn't fade away is who you are as a person. Who you are, what your virtues are and your morals are and what you really care about and your relationship with the Lord and all those things.
And it's not bad to be, it's a very good motivator to be attracted to a woman. You know, it should call us out of ourselves to go. You know, nowadays with the sorts of things that a lot of men fall into sin on online, has stopped a lot of men from going out and pursuing women because they'd rather, you know, watch their phone. Yeah. It's in their bed. You should see the beauty of a woman, not be addicted to those things, get off those things, and then pursue them. That's a very good motivator. But you should fundamentally ask the question of what is marriage and what is marriage for? And there's a lot of things that we can say about marriage. We're both married. I've been married for 6 years. Rowdy, how long have you been married?
About to be 2 years. Just started my journey.
2 years. Man, yeah. He's almost through the two hardest years of the marriage, so that's good.
And I mean, like, we're talking about marriage here, and obviously if there's some older listeners out there, you know, the first thought is, oh, these guys don't know much. You know, they haven't experienced it, and we haven't, right? We haven't. We probably have not been through the toughest parts of our marriage that are to come, but that's not to say.
But we've also been through some pretty tough parts of our marriage.
Yeah, but it's also not to say that we shouldn't know and believe that we're bonded to our souls are bound. Like that's just how it is, you know, thick or thin, till death do us part. And because if we start thinking right now that, you know, things might get tough. And if they do, we might just go our separate ways. Like, that's not a good mentality to have. You need to have the mentality that, no, this is a bond forever.
Yeah, and that's what marriage is. Like, ultimately, something that really helped me look at marriage was a Shakespeare sonnet, which I really liked. So this is Sonnet 116 that I think tells us a lot about marriage. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempest and is never shaken, that is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown although his height be taken. Love is not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not within his brief house and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error and upon me provest, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. Love is everlasting. It's not something that can be broken. It's not something that can be shaken. What is love? What is marriage? It is that lasting bond that never ends between two people. And you owe it to your spouse to work on your marriage. Mm-hmm. And to, if that fire no longer exists, then give what John Sr. said a try on how to make love grow. Write him a poem.
Yeah.
Sing him a song. Take up the marital bed once again. If you want your marriage to die an early death, stop going to the marital bed. But if you're on a rocky sea with your spouse, do that. Do some of the things that have always made love grow.
Yeah.
Love is one of the most beautiful things in the world. It's the building block of our entire society. It's the image of the Holy Trinity, which begets. It's beautiful. And every man and every woman who feels so called should do whatever they can do to get married and get married young. As long as you know what marriage is about, that it's a sacrament, that it's lifelong, that it lasts forever, that it can't be shaken, that what you put into it in terms of watering it and fertilizing it will be what you get out of it. So yeah, but we should choose well. And that's what this is all about. We need to choose well.
These are truths that you just said, that marriage is a bond that lasts forever. And it's kind of hard to hear that these days because we live in a selfish culture. Like, what am I getting out of this marriage when it should be flipped? What are you giving to this marriage? And so I know there's a lot of cases, and our culture is a breeding ground for selfish marriages. We just need to reorient ourselves to think about marriage in every way that you just said, because I know there's cases out there and there's nuances to be had about this or that, but ultimately the ideal that every one of us should strive for is that marriage is a sacrament between a man and a woman that lasts forever.
It's worth giving your whole life for. It's worth dying to yourself, to your own ego, doing something to be uncomfortable for your spouse. It's worth everything. And if you don't do that, if you don't pick well, then the next story is for you. I thought this was very similar to a story that I recently heard about a woman who was charged with manslaughter when her son was a school shooter. And the story's called A Boy and His Mother, and the page is 182. A schoolboy brought his mother a book that he had stolen from one of his fellows. She was so far from correcting him for it that she rather encouraged him. As he grew bigger, he would be still keeping his hand in your with somewhat of greater value, till he came at last to be taken in the matter and brought to justice for it. His mother went along with him to the place of execution, where he got leave of the officers to have a word or two in private with her. He put his mouth to her ear, and under pretext of a whisper, bit it clear off. This impious, unnatural villainy turned everybody's heart against him more and more. Well, good people, says the boy, here you see me an example, both upon the matter of shame and a punishment. and it is this mother of mine that has brought me to it. For if she had but whipped me soundly for the book I stole when I was a boy, I should never have come to the gallows for pilfering now that I am a man." And I think these go well together. You've got to choose well and still choose, but choose well. Your actions will have consequences, but your actions will influence them greatly. And you will be held to a certain degree, to a certain extent, liable one day for these actions, for what you did or didn't do for your children when you were bringing them up. And the way that you bring them up is the way that they will go for the most part. It's a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
And so we need to be mindful of that, especially in our day and age when there are so many school shooters or so many having these deaths of despair. What have we done as parents?
People look at the guns and all the other reasons, but they don't look back at the home. What was the home life like? And I mean, this story, you kind of like immediately when I had read this one, because I remember reading it, I had a knee-jerk reaction, and it can take away from his wrongdoing, right? Oh, it's all the mother's fault. And that's not, I don't think that's necessarily what it's saying.
No, he's getting what's just.
Yeah, he's getting what he deserves. But the point is, it could have all been prevented if his mother had done her duty, right? And disciplined her child as she should have, as was just.
She got what she deserved as well, with him biting her ear off. That's a gnarly part of the story.
Mike Tyson, bro.
That happened recently with a mom who buys the gun for the school shooter who went and killed kids. And yeah. She's charged with manslaughter, as she should be. We mainly need to look into ourselves, into our own families, because who knows what they did in their family. And that's not important. We should really focus on our own and try to make ours the best we can, raise our kids in the way that they ought to go.
You can get a little overstressed out on especially with my first kid and second on the way, is you get stressed out of like, man, I'm going to mess my kid up. I'm going to mess them up somehow, and they're going to be broken when they get older, and they're going to have all these problems because I didn't do this or that. And then you kind of think, don't stress about it. What's going to happen is going to happen. But I think there's a healthy balance there of a good stress. You should worry about these things. You should worry about what you say around your kids. You should worry about how you educate them. You should worry about how you discipline them, because there's a wrong and a right way to do most things. And so it's good to have that balance there of stressing out over how to raise your child. You shouldn't overstress about it over every little decision. You should do what comes natural in some cases, but you also shouldn't just be so lackadaisical about it and not care what your kid does 24/7 and let them pretty much raise themselves, right? No, you need to step up and be a parent and do your duty.
One of the most important parts is to keep first things first. What's the point? What's the whole purpose of a life? If we can't understand that, then of course we can't raise our kids.
Yeah.
If you don't understand the purpose of your life, how are you going to be able to help them understand the purpose of their life? And why do you think that they won't commit suicide if they never understand that purpose? So first you have to understand, why is it important? Why is life good? Why is it meaningful? Why is it good that I exist? Who is it that created me and why? And once you formulate those things, you have a clear picture of where to go. You should raise them up in truth. And as long as you can get them there, you've never failed. If your kids end up in heaven, you haven't failed. You know, they might not be very good at reading. They might not be very good at math. Okay. They need to be good humans.
Yeah.
They need to understand how the world works, live in real life. And ultimately, they need to understand that God created them for a reason and live in that. But a lot of times we put a lot of pressure on all the other things and we never once think about God. Do you have another story?
Yeah, I got one more.
Great.
It's two, actually. And I found it interesting because it's two stories in here. One of them says one side. One of them pushes one side. The other one pushes the other side of the story. And so it kind of goes to show, it kind of contradicts itself. But I also think it shows that there's different circumstances for every case. Not that everything is relative. I think there's circumstances that draw out that we need to discern in every scenario.
Yeah, we're given prudence, hopefully.
A dog and a wolf.
Great.
Oh man, you know when like you flip open the hymnal or some other book and you almost slip right to the page?
Yeah, yeah.
How good that feels?
I was on page 146 when I flipped. So
you're already there.
Pretty good.
All right, a dog and a wolf. There was a haggard carrion of a wolf, and a jolly sort of gentle dog, with good flesh upon its back, that fell into company together upon the king's highway. The wolf was wonderfully pleased with his companion, and as inquisitive to learn how he brought himself to that blessed state of body. "Why," says the dog, "I keep my master's house from thieves, and I have very good meat, drink, and lodging for my pains. Now, if you'll go along with me and do as I do, you may fare as I fare." The wolf struck up the bargain, and so away they trotted together. But as they were jogging on, the wolf spied a bare place about the dog's neck, where the hair was worn off. "Brother," says he, "how comes this?" "Oh, that's nothing," says the dog, "but the fretting of my collar a little." "Nay," says the other, "if there be a collar in the case, I know better things than to sell my liberty for a crust." So the moral of that one being, don't sell your liberty just to get something nice. Yeah. You know?
You know, I took that. You can take that very literally, actually. The last line, I know better things than to sell my liberty for a crust.
Yeah, that's kind of the moral at the end right there. Just, it tells you.
Aesop does that a lot. The last sentence is often the whole moral. I like that because oftentimes we do sell our liberty for a little bit of crust, literally. We might sell, you know, our liberty to be free, to be truly free. And yet we're so addicted to food that it inhibits us, you know, or we might be so addicted to the television that we're not free to do as we ought to do, to live life as we ought to live.
Yeah.
Because everybody who sins is a slave to sin.
Yeah. And so that one, like you were just talking about, is about, you know, don't sell your liberty, right? Just for something, some pleasure.
But what's the flip side?
But the next one, so this one's called A Doll with a String at its Foot. It's on page 283 if you want to follow along. A country fellow took a doll and tied a string to his leg and so gave him to a little boy to play with. The doll did not much like his companion and upon the first opportunity gave him the slip and away into the woods again, where he was shackled and starved. When he came to die, he reflected upon the folly of exposing his life in the woods rather than live in an easy servitude among men.
Very interesting.
So, you know, that one is saying, why would you sell your life to live a life of misery or supposed misery instead of living a life as a servant? You don't have your liberty as you don't have as much liberty as a free man. You're a servant, but it's still better than the life of starvation.
Yeah. The grass is not always greener on the other side.
Yeah. So I just found that interesting that the story just previously, the wolf and the dog, talks about the wolf is kind of the protagonist in this one in a sense of like, yeah, I'm not going to sell my liberty and put a collar around my neck just so I can get a nice dinner. I'd rather live free. And this one, you know, this
sell your doll, liberty for the servitude sometimes nice.
Yeah. You know? and it's kind of in the doll, the bird in this story with the string on his foot. This one is the protagonist here in a sense that it's, he should have sold a little bit of liberty in order to live a better life.
Yeah.
And even though that seems contradictory, I do think there's wisdom in both of those stories, depending on where you are in your life.
The question is, what does it mean to live a good life?
Yeah.
How do I do that? And, you know, what we're doing in our modern day isn't working. We have more suicides in America among teenagers than any other time in history. Way after air conditioning and iPhones and everything. And if you're poor in America, that means you have one TV and one car.
Yeah.
You know, you might have food stamps. You're still eating steaks every now and then. Like,
yeah,
that's poor in America.
Yeah, I think.
But we're still committing suicide. So yeah, we need to put those first things first of what's important in life.
What are we willing to pay in order to get that? And is it right to pay that price? Is it a price worth it?
All of life requires sacrifice.
Yeah.
The question is, who will you sacrifice to?
Yeah. In the wolf's case, you know, his price was his freedom. Was he willing to sacrifice freedom in order to have the good meal? He could eat in the wild, it just wouldn't have been as good. And the sacrifice for the doll or the bird was his quote unquote freedom and not having to live with this boy.
Yeah.
But the price he paid was starvation.
And the question ultimately is, what is freedom? It's the ability to do what you ought to do.
Yeah.
It's not license, which enables us to just do whatever you want. And as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else, then it's freedom. No, it's the ability to do what you ought. But you have to know, what should my life be about?
You could apply these, if we're going more literal in a sense of situations in life, right? So if there's a homeless man who's living on the street, in the wild, per se, mm-hmm. and
his servitude... In California, that's probably pretty true.
And his servitude would just be, you know, having to get a job and work hours, you know, work for the man, right? That's his servitude. And some people just don't want to do that. And I get it. Working for the man is not fun sometimes.
Yeah, everybody works for the man.
It's the right thing to do. That's a worthy sacrifice to live a better life, is to be in that quote-unquote servitude to better yourself, you know? But in the wolf's case, I feel like more of a scenario for that would be, is it worth my time if I'm working in a corporate office to get this promotion? I'm going to get this promotion. I'm going to make, you know, six figures now. My life's going to be so great. I'm going to buy the car, buy the bigger house, you know, and do all the things.
Not have any time with my family.
Not have any time. I've collared myself to that job now, right? And I feel like that those are practical examples of the two stories and why, even though the book contradicts itself with two different morals for kind of the same case, it just depends on where you're coming from.
Well, so I've got a good ending story for you. This is something that we ought never to forget, what this story has. And if you keep this in your mind every day of your life, you will change as a person. You will live as a much better person. Two young men and a cook. And the page is 132. Two young fellows slipped into a cook's shop, and while the master was busy at his work, one of them stole a piece of flesh and conveyed it to the other. The master missed it immediately and challenged them with the theft. He that took it swore he had none of it, and he that had it swore as desperately that he did not take it. The cook, reflecting upon the conceit, said, "Well, my master," says he, "these frauds and fallacies may pass upon men, but there's an eye above that sees through them." And so we shouldn't forget that God sees all. Mm-hmm. He is with you every moment of every day, watching you. So that means a couple things.
Yeah.
We should recognize that, and it'll change your life. But you should also talk to him. So, Rowdy, what did you think of Aesop's Fables?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the—I don't even know how you describe it—just the simplicity of it. I enjoyed just the shortness of the stories and how hard some of them punch, right? Even to your personal life. Some things I kind of got away from it, like I said with the animals, was, you know, all the animals have a type, which was interesting, and how that can kind of reignite our imagination to bring it into other literature of how to recognize these types a little better. But some things I thought overall, I kind of wrote them down of just, I feel like a lot of them were repetitive sometimes. And here's some notes that I got from the whole book, just real quick, just points. They're about being wary of who you put your trust in. You should discern that. Mm-hmm. Don't mess around with God. Know yourself, your strengths, and your weaknesses. Use your head, not your eyes. Quality over quantity. Don't brag. And don't leave one danger and step right into another danger.
Very good.
I felt like so many of them touch on those points that if that's all I got away from this, those are all treasures.
Yep.
Right?
That's great.
Treasures to live by. Mm-hmm. But, I mean...
There's a lot of treasure here. You know, you should read Aesop's Fables to your kids for sure.
Yeah.
And you should buy the Lestrange edition, and it will stretch you because the language is a little bit difficult.
That was hard to... get sometime. I felt yeah. I by the end of the fables, I was able to kind of read it in my head a little faster, because when you first start reading some of those words, it's just not in our vocabulary.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very thankful that we picked this book to begin, because I think this helped me to understand, you know, what is a moral of the story? Because I've never looked at that before. Why should we read these? What is this trying to tell us? This coming 2 weeks, we are reading Arabian Nights. There's two translations.
Yep.
Andrew Lang and Sir Robert...
Richard Burton, I think.
Oh, yeah, Richard Burton. Way off.
And just so you're aware, and John Senior puts this on his list too, One of those has some more racy themes than others. And so you should be a little wary of that, right? If you're buying this to put on your...
Or just read the racy one, you know?
Well, the caveat there is more of, if you're buying this to put on your kid's bookshelf,
yeah,
you may want to...
Buy the Andrew Lang.
You may want to reach for the Andrew Lang if this is going to be for kids. But that doesn't say that you shouldn't read Richard Burton's, no. Right? You should. It's good to read those things.
We're not canceling.
But our... yeah, we're not going to cancel Richard Burton. Which, man, I looked up some stuff and on Reddit.
Oh, yeah.
So many people
that's
are like...
That's a dark hole there.
Oh, so. Well, so many people. If Richard Burton was alive today, canceled. They're all like, this... I'm not going to... Yeah, he'd have been canceled. But, so that being said, if you'd like to follow along, definitely doing Arabian Nights for the next one. And the next couple that we're going to do, just so if you want to look forward to something, or if something's not really interested to you, we're going to do the Bad Kids Book of Beasts after Arabian Nights. We're going to move on to Mother Goose. And then, which this will be the furthest out that I go from now on, is we're going to go see an opera. We're going to go see an opera in a couple weeks or more
La
like a
Bohème
month.
By Puccini.
Yep. And so we're going to step away from the 1,000 good books, and we're going to move on. We're going to go do something live, and we're going to go see an opera, which...
Get dressed up,
and take a wise
what we're going to have to say about that.
I know it, yeah.
We'll see. So you should listen to La Bohème.
Yeah, so
and
please
go see it.
Check it out, and that way...
Maybe go see it with us. Well, it'll be at Bass Performance Hall in April.
Yeah, Bass Performance Hall, Fort Worth, Texas. Come on out. Hopefully we'll see you. You probably won't recognize us, but...
Yeah.
You'll be there. We'll be with each other in spirit.
Oh, yeah.
We'll see you guys in 2 weeks, and never forget, we were made for the stars, but planted in the soil.
Peace.